You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer, Patrick Antonetti. One guest on this week's podcast, and a little something different, I think you will enjoy it. Alan Sepinwall is Rolling Stone's chief TV critic. He writes just brilliant pieces when it comes to the shows of the moment that you're watching. He's currently just on an incredible run when it comes to his pieces on Succession, which is what the focus of most of our conversation is in this podcast. If you like Barry, he's been all over that. And then obviously previous, his work on The Sopranos, Game of Thrones, Mad Men, The Wire, Star Wars. If you're a television fan, you probably know who Alan Sepinwall is. He's one of the great writers out there when it comes to this stuff. And we go pretty deep just on his process, how he puts together his Succession reviews, what he thinks about when he's doing these kind of reviews on television. How important is it to stick the landing when it comes to a series finale? And we get into Mad Men and The Wire and Breaking Bad, etc. So, we end on some talk on the Star Wars universe and just how he sees all the various new Star Wars projects that are out there. So a little something different, not sports media, but really one of the terrific writers of culture in the United States, Alan Sepinwall of Rolling Stone, coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, I'm very excited about this guest. Is a little off the beaten path for this podcast. Alan Sepinwall is Rolling Stone's chief TV critic. If you are interested in television, and particularly prestige television, his name is probably familiar. In my opinion, nobody has written better work on Succession than Alan Sepinwall, but he's really well known in terms of, like, if you're a fan of The Sopranos or The Wire or Barry, again, any kind of prestige television Alan Sepinwall is writing about. But it's not just like reviews that he does. He takes you, I think, really inside like the filmmaker or the storytelling process in addition to giving you plot points. And that's a real skill when it comes to writing. And I'm pleased to be joined by Alan Sepinwall. Alan, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I know this is, you don't do a lot of sports media podcasts, Alan. Although you've been on Trainer's podcast at Sports Illustrated, so this is not so foreign to you.
Yeah, if you're not careful, I'll start talking about the Knicks for a half an hour.
Well, that's fine. Well, at this point, you'll be talking about them for the next 7 months because they won't be playing. So, Might as well get some. No, I'm not knocking. I'm just saying you might as well get some off-season chatter. The league is always better when the Knicks are good. So I'm certainly not a Knicks hater. All right. I want to get more into process here, because, there's a number of places where you'll be able to discuss, the show's excels, but I want to talk about Succession. Cause again, your work has amplified my enjoyment of this show. So one of the things that, at least from my perspective as an outsider, is that you must have at least the show in advance, generally speaking, to be able to write the kind of piece that you write and publish it so shortly after the episode is first run. Could you take my listeners into the process of how it works for you?
Okay, and that is generally but not always the case. And certainly it would be like physically impossible to publish something right after it's finished if I hadn't seen it in advance. And so usually I get episodes in advance. With Succession this season, I've tended to get them on the Wednesday morning before they air. I watch them that day. I go about my business otherwise. I take notes while I watch it. I do other things. And then either Thursday or Friday, I sort of have ruminated and figured out exactly what I want to say. And then I spend, several hours actually writing the recaps. But for instance, on the series finale this weekend, I am not seeing it in advance. They didn't give it to any of us. They claim, like, even if they wanted to, they couldn't because it's still being edited at this point. So right. You're going to have a bunch of really grouchy TV writers on the Sunday night of Memorial Day weekend having to watch this live and formulate a thought immediately afterwards. I've had to do this a few times in the past for the final seasons of Game of Thrones, for the second half of Mad Men, and a few others. And you can do it. It's sort of like being an athlete. At a certain point, you start to feel a little too old for this. And I may doze off in the middle of writing the recap, but I'm going to try to get it done on Sunday.
By the way, they're not editing anything. They just don't want to give it up. And I can respect that. So when you're part of this process, are you someone who will do you stop and like rewatch scenes? Do you have your laptop nearby and you start to like maybe jot down some themes, or maybe you figure out a lead? Like how I'm so fascinated by the process. Like how does it work for someone like you in order to get these pieces to where you want them to be?
I have a really obsessive, you know, bordering on pathological method, which is when I watch an episode of TV, if it's something I'm going to recap especially, but in most cases, if I'm going to review it, I have my laptop out. I type really, really fast. It's the one sort of, it's the best skill I retained from high school. And so I'm basically acting like a court stenographer and I'm taking notes. I'm writing down everything that is happening in a scene. You know, Kendall enters the room, you know, Roman says a joke and I write down whatever the joke is. You know, this happens, that happens, you know, cousin Greg, you know, spills some lemon soda on Decision Darwin, whatever. And then in the midst of that, I am also, if I have a particular opinion on something, or if there's a particular line or thing that happens that I know I'm going to want to refer to in my recap, I write that out in all caps right away and keep going. So that way, like, it's a pain in the butt, but when it comes time for me to then go and write, I have this real-time, not only list of basically everything, but this real-time reaction of, I thought this. Like, this idea came into my head, I can link this to this, et cetera. And so in the old days with some shows, I would go back and rewatch a second time, sometimes even a third. But I've gotten pretty good about not having to do that. Occasionally, I will go back and check a scene if I'm not 100% sure the order in which something happened or if I didn't get the quote quite right. But I don't usually have to do that.
We all have editors. Is your editor as obsessive a fan of the television that you write about as you are?
I just changed editors a few months ago, and they're both obsessive TV fans, although not always about the exact same thing. So that's been interesting to see, like, who is excited about one thing versus who is excited about another. It's definitely been fun sometimes to convert an editor to a show they don't care about. So my former editor, I would not stop talking to her about this HBO show called The Leftovers that like five people remember, but I think it's one of the greatest things that ever aired. And eventually she watched it. And then suddenly that was all we talked about for months and months. So my current editor is a big Succession fan, but he's not getting the screeners. And so I feel almost guilty that he's editing these recaps before he's watched the episode.
What, you know, to me, like, the skill level that you and the other people who really, really do this well, again, I don't know this, but I'll sort of make a presumption. You must have some kind of relationship with the filmmakers, at least even in terms of like interviewer and subject every now and then. So let's just take Succession for a second. Like, have you talked multiple times to the filmmakers? And if so, has that helped your writing process when you're ultimately putting what you put down, you know, pen to paper that someone like myself then ultimately reads?
That is a good assumption on your part. And it is often the case, and usually the case with a lot of the shows I write about. This is a rare exception to that. The only Succession interview I have ever done is I interviewed Sarah Snook several weeks ago after, you know, the episode where Logan died. And that's it. I didn't really start covering the show heavily until season three, in part because it took a really long time to warm to it, which is sort of unusual for me, especially for a show I wound up loving as much as I do now. Usually, though, I do a lot of these interviews. I'll do season-ending postmortems, series-ending postmortems. I'll interview writers. I'll interview directors. Sometimes I'll interview actors, especially if the actors are really good at articulating what they do, like Snook, like, you know, a Ray Seahorn on Better Call Saul, you know, whatever. And that can be helpful. But at this point, I've been doing it long enough that I feel like even if I never did those interviews, I would be able to take a lot out of just what I'm seeing on the screen, the decisions they're making, especially when I've been watching a show for a few years and have a much better sense of what they like to do and what they're good at and what they aren't.
Matt Sarah-Snook is just a brilliant actress. And just to actually hear her talk like in an interview and then you hear the Australian accent, it's very mind-blowing to then watch her performances, Shiv. But, I mean, she is just a phenomenal actress. How do you judge success when it comes to your pieces? And is there any metric element involved in your judging, meaning certain amount of page views or, you know,
I mean, success to me is if I feel it turned out well. And sometimes I think it really does. I think most of my Succession pieces this year I've been really proud of. A lot of the time, like I'll write a recap and at a certain point I just sort of feel like I don't quite have it, but I need to write something. So this is what it's going to be and that'll be fine. And I haven't had that feeling at all with this. So for me, it's more of a creative thing than anything else. I can look at traffic numbers if I want to. I've been at other places where my editors have basically locked me out of the traffic views because they know that, like, if I had access to them, that's all I would do all day. And so right. Over the years, the fact that they stopped doing that, I think, took me out of the habit of it. So even though I can track what we do now on RollingStone.com, I mostly don't. And sometimes I'm even surprised by when I have a thing that does really well versus I have a thing that doesn't, because it can be really random. I wrote this piece last month, I think, on an Amazon show called Citadel, and it was the most read story on RollingStone.com all month, and I didn't think really anybody would care about that. So it's the internet can be a strange place sometimes, but to me it's mainly, do I think this thing is good, and do like people then tell me afterwards, wow, you made me think about this episode in a different way, which is always sort of the goal.
It's very clear, and understandably so, how many people who work in the news media love this show. You know, and you go on Twitter anytime, it's a very, very big discussion point, particularly a very, very big discussion point for people who work at major, major legacy places. That said, Alan, and you would know this a lot better than me, if you were going to compare like the literal viewership of Succession to many other shows, it wouldn't be close. Like, it's nowhere near the most popular show in America. So I set that sort of up to ask you, like, how do I sort of phrase this? How much are we being inundated by Succession because it's of such interest to the media versus the actual interest of the show itself?
I think it's both, because this is far from the first time you've had a situation like this where the actual viewership is tiny compared to, you know, how much it's written about. Mad Men was a classic case of that. Like, the Mad Men ratings, which were easier to gauge at the time because there wasn't streaming, there wasn't as much time-shifted viewing, et cetera, were still a fraction of something like, you know, Burn Notice, which literally, I think, aired on the same night in their first seasons. But you didn't see nearly as much writing about Burn Notice because even though that was a more popular show and a show that the people who watched it really liked, there was a lot less to say about that. And I think that's often where you see people gravitating to these shows, especially with the kind of recapping that I do a lot of. It's, you want to find shows that people really want to think about and really want to talk about and really want to argue about. And, you know, with a procedural or even something like Yellowstone, there's just not as much necessarily there to dig into. And so you would probably rather just watch it. And so you don't necessarily see people going as crazy about it, either in terms of the amount they write about it or just in the amount of like social media chatter that you see.
Yeah, Yellowstone's a great example, just obviously given the viewership numbers. How do you feel just conceptually, philosophically about writing pieces where you're ultimately making predictions of what will happen to these characters? And obviously in the case of Succession, the ultimate question is always sort of who quote unquote ends up on top by the end.
I definitely do it a lot. I even did it a little bit in my latest piece on the penultimate episode. And I always feel weird about it, both because I'm usually terrible at it. You know, when you go back and look at most of my predictions, they're pretty awful almost all of the time. When I've taken old recaps and put them into books like I did for the Soprano sessions or Breaking Bad 101, I have to obviously strip all of that out. And I found in some cases, like, that's what most of the recap was about. So I have to start over. I think we're sort of naturally drawn to that. There's a sense of like, you want to maybe not outsmart the show, but you want to sort of say, all right, I've been watching this a while. I feel like I know where it's going, even though it's already happened. So it's not like sports gambling or something where you're still waiting on it. Like, you're talking about something that was written, directed, edited, completed months ago. And yet you assume, like, you know, you can sort of have a read on it. But like, I do it. I'm naturally just, you know, feel compelled to do it. And we all do. And that's why it'll be a nice thing when I'm watching the finale on Sunday, is I will no longer have to predict anything. It just, the story will be complete.
Do you have a personal preference as a viewer as to how that show should end?
A couple of people have asked me that. You know, I even turned down like being part of some magazine piece where they were asking different critics that exact question, because I didn't necessarily have an answer. I know some people have talked about, like, you know, wouldn't it be funny if it ends with Greg in charge of the company?
Right. Seeing that, that's kind of the hot new.
And to me, that I think that would probably be disappointing, although Jesse Armstrong is a great writer and maybe he would find a way to make it satisfying. But it feels like a little bit too jokey for a show that, yes, I think is primarily a comedy, but is also sort of laced with tragedy and despair. And I think Greg is ultimately too light a character that even if the idea of putting him on the throne is to say, look how terrible everything is that this idiot winds up in charge, it still largely plays as a joke. And it doesn't feel like this is a show that should ultimately end on a joke like that.
One of the things that when you were coming on, I wanted to ask you about is the idea of sticking the landing for these shows,
yeah,
which I just find fascinating. In the midst of just, you know, I just sort of was just sort of taking my own notes. There's probably a million of these, but I was trying to think about before you came on, all right, what shows really had a season, had a series finale, which was incredibly satisfying to its audience? So Breaking Bad, Newhart, Mad Men. Saying Elsewhere, maybe I'm wrong about that. You better sense of that. The Wire, I think more Wire fans would probably say they were satisfied than not. Maybe MASH fits into that. So when thinking about this show, which has been a brilliant show, particularly like the last couple of years, like, how important is it for this to finish strong? And would people think of it differently if the series finale does not match the quality of everything that came before it?
I think in general, it matters more with shows that are very sort of plot forward, where what happens is ultimately the most important thing. Because if you biff that at the end, if you don't actually have the story go to a satisfying place, you're going to leave a bad taste in people's mouths. And I've seen that happen a number of times. But I've also seen a lot of finales of beloved shows that were either sort of divisive or outright disliked. You know, the Sopranos finale, there's still people arguing about whether that, you know, was good or not, or what that meant or anything. You know, you mentioned Mad Men. Correct. I remember the night the Mad Men finale aired, there's a lot of people like, I don't know how I feel that, like, the final note is like, Don finds enlightenment and writes a Coke commercial. But what I'm saying is, I don't feel like that, or even Lost. Definitely there were people at the time who were very angry at Lost. And you know, for them, I guess they were thinking more about the plot than anything else. And it was not as strong on that front. But I think, like, if you love the show, you're still going to ultimately love the show. Whereas if you're waiting to see what happens and they really mess that up at the end, the example I always give is not a drama. It's How I Met Your Mother, which was that CBS sitcom. And you're like, you're waiting 9 years to sort of get to the story of how he meets the mother. And you finally get there, and 30 seconds after you get there, you find out that the mother is dead and he's now getting ready to go and date Kobe Smulders' character. And it's just like, wait, what? Like, this is what you've been leading towards? This is terrible. And now I never, ever want to go back and rewatch any of that. And that's a show I once really, really liked. So it can happen. I definitely understand why people feel that way. I don't think this is going to be one of those shows. Like, even if people are not satisfied with the conclusion, I think the affection for it is so strong. Like, just, you know, personally, if it ends with Greg on the throne, I'm going to think that's probably not what I want, but it's not going to lessen my overall feelings about it.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I think obviously how you felt about the 2016 election had a lot to do with how you felt about the election episode that Succession just did. And one of the things I want to ask you about that particular episode is it's been a long time since I watched something and kind of viscerally felt uncomfortable about a TV show, like in a good way. I've watched so many like West Wings and shows like that, you know, where they'll have like the election episode and like, you know, it could be great, good television, interesting. You never really, you know, you walk away and then go back to the rest of your life and you don't even sort of think about it. But they sort of nailed that, I thought. Even to the point where, you know, in the follow-up episode where Kieran Culkin's character goes outside in the middle of like a protest in New York, and it sort of is a good flashback to Shiv Roy saying things do happen. You know, in terms of like, they didn't just make a night of television. They may have changed the country. As someone who writes about this stuff, to me, that was really just some brilliant, like, writing and filmmaking to be able to actually turn a television television show ultimately about a television show on election night, but to make it that tense and compelling was pretty brilliant. I wonder just how you saw that episode in relation to some of the other great episodes you've written about over the years in different shows.
That was agonizing to watch. Like, I thought it was great, but like, I got that screen around 9 a.m. And I put it on a few minutes after that, and I did not finish it until 11 or 11:30 because every 5 minutes or so I had to pause, take a breath. At least once I like went for a walk around the block and came back and had to keep going just because it felt so raw and so evocative of the, you know, the worst aspects of the last two elections and just all a lot of things that have happened in the last 8 years or so of American political life that I'm like, I don't really want to be experiencing this again, but they're making me, and I had to go. And it was just sort of like magnificently put together. It was just excruciating. There's a couple of episodes of The Office that are sort of like that, where the first time I watched it, I thought, this is incredible. I will never put this on again as long as I live. You cannot pay me enough.
Right. That's funny. One thing about The Sopranos, David Chase seemed to like you. He really took a I don't know if David Chase is from Jersey like yourself.
We grew up in adjacent towns several decades apart.
Ah, okay, so yeah, so he's a Jersey guy. Probably read the Star Ledger, your former place. Do you, that obviously was professionally incredibly advantageous to you, but why do you think that was? You know, there are writers sometimes that a filmmaker, they just gravitate to. For whatever reason, they got a great rapport, they like them, they trust them, and they ultimately give them things that they don't maybe give other writers. Why has that been the case for you and David Chase?
I mean, definitely the home field advantage cannot be understated. Like, he grew up, I think he delivered the Star Ledger at some point as like a childhood job. So he has tremendous affection for the paper. Matt Zollerseitz, my former colleague at the Star Ledger with whom I co-wrote The Soprano Sessions, wrote about the show for the first 3 years of it. He wrote it incredibly well. And he really impressed David with sort of his passion for the filmmaking and his understanding of what David was trying to do. And so right, you know, there and then he was already sort of predisposed to like me, I guess, when I took over. And it helped that I think he felt that I got what he was trying to do. And I didn't ask the same questions that everybody else was asking him. And he is someone who has very little patience for answering stuff he doesn't want to answer or that he thinks is dumb. And I've, you know, been sort of lucky or good enough or whatever to usually not try his patience. So we've had a good relationship over the years.
I mean, I'm sure the answer is going to be yes. And then, you know, you can sort of expand on it because that's what I'm interested in. But like, how much does being from New Jersey influence your tastes? I know that for me, spending most of my life as an adult in New York City, and now I live in Toronto, like those two cities absolutely influence like me just in terms of how I think and some of the things I like and experience. Luckily, working at Sports Illustrated, I got a chance to see the world, so I don't feel that too insular. But for you, as someone who writes about culture, you know, to put it in the broad capital C, like how much does being from New Jersey influence all the stuff, all your thinking, basically?
No, it absolutely does. And it's a little bit New Jersey. I think a lot more of it is just sort of like tri-state area, you know, Because, you know, you're either in New York a lot, or you're like reading in the paper or watching on the TV or whatever about things in New York, and you're interacting with those kinds of people. There's definitely, like, from New Jersey, there's always the sense of like you're near the action, but you're not in the action. And that was definitely one of the themes of The Sopranos. And so when you have things like that about people who never quite get up to the level of what they want, I very much can understand that mentality, because I was from a place that was near it, but not in it. So that's absolutely a part of it as well.
You know, you write for you, you write for the audience, people like me who consume it, but ultimately as part of that audience, there's a chance that the actors who perform in this stuff read you. There's definitely a chance, I think, that the filmmakers read you. I know the PR people for sure read you. But is it important? Like, is it important for you? Like, do you want to, like, eventually hear from Jesse Armstrong or Sarah Snook or, you know, previous, like, you know, like the Game of Thrones founders, or obviously you've heard from David Chase, but, like, I'm not asking like that you want them to like what you write, because that's not really the point. But are you interested that they are interested in what you have to write, because they are ultimately, you know what I mean? They're creating the world that you are ultimately engaged in as a writer.
It's a strange thing, especially since social media really, you know, became big, of like, now you're actually hearing more directly from the people whose shows you're covering, which includes actors, which includes writers, directors, producers, etc. And I get along with a lot of these people, you know, some of whose work I love, some of whose work I think is just okay, but they're, you know, nice people, or they're a fun Twitter follower or whatever. And so it's this weird thing, but in some ways it's very healthy. Because like, it's a reminder that these are people and you can write negative things without making it personal. And I always try to do that. I try to say like, I hate something, but I'm not going to be mean in the way I talk about it. But in terms of like, whether I want to hear from them, I'd be lying if I said like, it wasn't cool if someone I thought was great reached out to me and said, hey, I read your thing. Like, you know, I'm a human being. Yeah. But I can't ultimately be writing for that audience. Like my recaps and my reviews are not my attempt to give network notes. They're, you know, they're designed for the audience, which is the reader, as opposed to the, you know, the people making the shows. And if they get something, if the people making the shows get something out of it, that's nice. But that, you know, that's a happy byproduct as opposed to the end goal.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying. Like, I really like, J. Smith Cameron on Twitter. I just think she's like very cool to engage with, like people who are really into her show. She plays Jerry Kelman, just for on Secessions, for people who don't know. And one or two times, like, she's either commented to me or retweeted me, and I was like, yeah, this is pretty damn cool. Like, someone, like an actress I really respect and I think is great, like, you know, for 20 seconds actually took some of my stupid sports media nonsense and sent it out there. So I do get that. But yeah, you can never really write for those people, because then I think you do a disservice to the
craft. And also the one other thing I would say is I've had an experience where it's gone the other way, where the people who work on the shows read me and are not happy with what I've written. And that can get unpleasant. Right. And obviously, like, I'm not going to, you know, couch my opinion to avoid that. But that's happened a number of times.
No, welcome to the sports media writing world, Alan. I want the something that like is curious to me, because I obviously experience in my world, but I don't know how it works for you. How often do you hear from public relations people about whether you're writing a review or some kind of takeout piece on a show? And are they trying at all, either before or afterwards, to manage the piece?
Usually, because I'm a critic and I'm not doing reporting, I basically don't hear from people before I do stuff, which is nice. But I will hear after, not a lot, definitely not as much as I may have earlier in my career. I think at a certain point, like, I've been doing this a long time, I'm considered to be at a certain level among my peers. And I think people know at this point, like, you're not going to like change my mind. And it's, you know, if anything, it'll be counterproductive if you do that. But I do hear occasionally. I will definitely hear it more if I get something if I get something that somebody else feels is factually wrong. And my instance of this, if you've got a couple of minutes, it's a good story. Okay.
Yeah, please.
This involves the 2016 election, sort of, amusingly enough, which is the Celebrity Apprentice was in its early years. And I thought it was really terrible. And I was someone who had liked original Recipe Apprentice a fair amount. in its first few seasons. And I wrote a column for the Star Ledger, basically lamenting the fact that, like, this show that once upon a time seemed like this fun little exercise in, you know, creativity and business and stuff, at a certain point had just become basically a testament to the ego of the guy hosting it, and how just sort of like everything was about kissing up to him, and every decision he was making seemed erratic. And thus, to me, it was not a surprise that ratings for Celebrity Apprentice were way down from the ratings for the original show in its first few years. I write this, publish it. The next day, I get a call from a young woman who says, I'm calling from the Trump Organization. Mr. Trump was hoping you would print a retraction of your column. And I said, what do you mean? What retraction? It's an opinion piece. And she said, well, there were some factual inaccuracies in there. And I said, what? And she said, well, you said that the ratings for Celebrity Apprentice are down, when in fact, and she starts rattling off different demographic statistics about previous seasons of Celebrity Apprentice. And I listen patiently and I stop her and I finally say, I was not comparing it to other Celebrity Apprentice. I was comparing it to the original run of the show, and the ratings are in fact way down, and the rest of it's opinion, so there's nothing to retract. And there's a very long pause, and in that pause, you can detect a whole lot about what is going to happen to this person when the phone call ends. And then she says, so you won't be printing a retraction then? And I said, no, I'm sorry. And we said goodbye.
Imagine
I did not, and I felt very bad for her for what she was about to have to deal with. But, like, you know, again, one of the nice things about being someone who are 99.9% of what you write is opinion is you don't usually have to deal with that.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is... Again, you've done so many shows and so many things that I'd be fascinated by. I could, you know, if I should really have you on for 64 hours and we could just do everything I want to do. But the Star Wars universe, I really enjoyed your work on Andor, which I really, really liked. I thought it actually found its stride by the end. I love Rogue One. You know, there's a lot of Star Wars fans who make the argument that that's truly the best Star Wars film. When both of us were young, like the whole notion of the Star Wars universe was essentially the movies, and you'd have to wait until you get the next one. Now it's all fluttered all over Disney Plus, sort of part of, I feel like, the prestige television universe. I know I'm asking you a very, very broad question, but whether it's Andor, whether it's The Mandalorian, whether it's like the spinoff or the short run series on Obi-Wan or Boba Fett, what is your sort of overall thought on just where this has gone as a television play? Because it's just really, really fascinating to me that they've actually been able to successfully franchise this now to create all these different television entities.
It's been interesting. I mean, definitely, like, the fact that they started off with The Mandalorian was great for them, because that was, especially in that first season, a really fun show that satisfied basically everyone. And it's so rare these days to find something where everybody likes it. And you would have varying degrees of that. And some people would complain about, you know, some episodes, like the one where they fought the people in the swamp to protect the village, like the Magnificent Seven ripoff. It's like, well, that's just filler. That's not advancing the story. And it's like, yeah, but was it entertaining? But for the most part, people really liked it. So that was good. And then it's been kind of up and down. And I think people mostly weren't huge fans of Obi-Wan or Book of Boba Fett. But then Andor came along and people loved that. And Mandalorian finally came back, and there were sort of mixed reactions to this season, but still, I think, mostly positive. That's been good. It's this interesting thing of Star Wars used to be about scarcity. You know, I grew up, I saw all three of the original movies in the theater, and especially by the time Return of the Jedi came around, because I was old enough to really appreciate at that point the fact that we'd had to wait 3 years from Empire to see it. So it was such a huge deal that, like, in the opening sequence of Return of the Jedi, when everyone's showing up at Jabba's palace one by one, the audience went nuts every time you saw somebody. Like, Lando Calrissian lowers his face mask slightly so you can see it's Billy Dee Williams, and spontaneous applause. He hasn't done anything. It's literally just, hey, it's Lando. And that's in part because, like, we had only gotten two of these other movies and we had to wait so long in between each of them. And now there is, if not Star Wars year round, we're reasonably close to that, you know, especially when you factor in the animated shows. And so suddenly it's a lot less special. And therefore, I think they have to be better overall to get that level of excitement. And I think Andor certainly was. And I think Mandalorian certainly was at the beginning. So it's possible, but it's definitely like it's, they've created a different kind of challenge for themselves now by trying to pump out so much of this stuff.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. They're sort of creating it to more super fans, but the super fan universe is gigantic. And I will say the season finale of The Mandalorian season one was incredible. And like that reminded me of like why I fell in love with it. I'm not just me, I'm millions. Why you fell in love with this as a kid. Well, listen, Alan, thank you for joining me. I cannot tell you how much your recaps of Succession have added to my enjoyment of this show. You're writing right now I don't throw this word around a lot, but you're really writing it like a LeBron in 2007 kind of clip.
Wow.
So keep it up. Alan Zeppenwall is Rolling Stone's chief TV critic. Go to rollingstone.com and find his work. You'd also obviously find him on Twitter. But again, if you are into the television shows that, you know, people are talking about on a daily basis, he's an absolute must read. Alan, thanks for making some time today, and continued success. Myself and my producer Patrick Antonetti, we promise you at least two downloads for every new piece. That's what we give you in exchange for coming on free today. Thank you for joining us on the Sports Media Podcast.
But between that and the LeBron James comparison, you have left me very humbled, Richard. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Alan Zeppenwall. I really enjoyed that. Check his work, guys. He's a terrific writer. Previous episodes over the last couple of weeks, we had Brian Curtis of The Ringer and Ben Strauss of The Washington Post talk about Pat McAfee's move to ESPN. Endeavor president and COO Mark Shapiro was on this podcast for about an hour. People seem to enjoy that, find that enlightening. Did something on the NFL's television schedule with Sports Media Watch's John Lewis. Peter King was on this podcast talking about the NFL. Daniel Jeremiah had Chad Finn and Austin Karp regulars on not too long ago. Dana O'Neill and Tim Layden on horse racing. Again, if you like these podcasts, please leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. That's how the podcast continues. I want to thank my hardworking producer, Patrick Antonetti, for all his hard work. I want to thank everybody at Odyssey for their support, and thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.